coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. I am out on job site right now with clients, but as always, we bring you nothing but new content here. Never repeat, never replay, always new stuff. And speaking of new things, old guest, new book. The new book, The Nucleus, is out. My Religion in the Rearview Mirror. We're going to be talking with W. Wallace Wagner tonight about alternative gospels in the Bible, why they may have been hidden by patriarchies, why they may have been shuffled away in the annals of history, and what some of those teachings actually mean in our modern world, you know, because when you start getting into the Gospel of Thomas, when you start getting into these are very, very interesting gospels that were removed by the Catholic Church. And then even more books were removed by, you know, King James and things like that many years later. So it's interesting to see how many edits the Bible has gone through. And when you look at things like the Gospel of Thomas, how it really contains a lot of deep, deep, deep-seated spirituality that seems to go really beyond the world of what we would know as standard everyday Christianity walk into a church. So welcome back to the show, W. Wallace Wagner. How are you doing?
Hello, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about
this.
Oh,
you're welcome.
Because this is, you know, Bible history is very interesting to me. It's always been fascinating, you know. Once again, the fact that the Bible was edited, then edited again by the church. And then not only that, but once Martin Luther got a hold of it, it went through another edit and revision and more things were removed. You know, Second Maccabees, things like that.
Yep.
And then, you know, the king got a hold of it and other things were removed. And it's like, wow, you know, when you start looking at a lot of the things that are removed from the Bible, you really start losing a lot of the, I guess, what you would see as the pillars of dogma, Wallace. You know, those things that really start making up, like the, I mean, even the idea of Trinity is really cast aside in the book of the Gospel of Thomas, because there's no salvific real passages in there. There's no, it's not like Christ as the Savior. It's like Christ as the Buddha, almost.
You know, that's the way I look at it now. You hit the nail on the head. Without a doubt, Christ taught two different tiers of knowledge, one for the Gentiles, us, the commoners, if you will, and a upper level to his disciples. And for me, this book of Thomas is totally upper level and really pertains to Jesus's teachings. It causes one to look at him more as a teacher than as a savior. And in that regard, you know, in my world, it goes pretty much hand in hand to what you mentioned with Buddha and Hinduism as well. I look at it from the standpoint now that those traditions, you know, were on earth thousands of years before Christianity ever was, and Christ did not, you know, incarnate in Calcutta to change Hinduism, certainly. But a lot of their beliefs tie into the upper tier beliefs of you know, Yeshua or Christ. And those upper tier beliefs, most of them were Gnostic flavored and most of them were taken out of the Bible. They weren't even, you know, included in the canon. They were considered for a little bit, then kicked out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of what I try to explain to people about that first Council of Nicaea, where of course the Nicene Creed came from, that came up with the pillars of the faith. But it was really the the fight against Arianism. It took me a second there to pop the capital A Arian into my head. And Arianism was this idea where, aside from Trinity, which, you know, tells you that Father, Son, Holy Spirit all coexist. They all take part in the same essence, esse qua esse, things like that. The Arians were like, oh, no, there's three, it's one God that wears a different face for whatever you need. And there were all these different, even esoteric versions of Christianity out there. It was very sected and segmented depending on where you lived, which is where a lot of these gospels come from, you know. And that's kind of what they did, was they had the big church meeting. They had to figure out how many angels danced on the head of a pin. and while they were figuring that out, they were like, okay, here's one right here, everybody. Who's reading this one on Tuesday nights? Put your hand up. Only the three of you? All right. Well, we can set that one aside. How about this one? Who's reading that one? And that's kind of how they solidified the story of Christ into the dogmatic story of the chapters of the Bible that we have now, you know. And there were a few things in there, like the Gospel of Thomas, where quite a number of sects read it, especially in the Middle East, Grecian areas, things like that. However, it wasn't accepted as dogma because it didn't follow that dogmatic storyline that they wanted. Because once again, never did he in the Gospel of Thomas, despite these amazing red word teachings in there. Red word, for those of you who don't know, would be the words of Christ in the Bible. Those words specifically, though, Wallace, are very different when you're talking about you are the stones. Like, God is in the stones and you're the stones. Like, I've said,
God is in everything. That you're not taught that, you know, in today's Christian settings.
Yeah.
But what I realize now, since my sighting back in 2016, it's been a progression, that God is in everything around me.
Yeah.
Everything around me is connected. So therefore, everything is part of God, and that includes me. In other words, I am a little God as well. I'm just lower in consciousness, and I can point to, you know, biblical phrases that support that, including John 14, if you wish, that we'll even do, you know, miracles greater than Christ did. So, you know, let that ring true for a minute. How can you do miracles greater than what Christ did? But we are little gods too. We are truly children, and we have a lot of growing up to do.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that we are little gods too. One of the things that I've held for years, Wallace, after my years of religious study of different cultures, specifically Kabbalistic studies, things like that. I am a big believer that the whole reason that the Sanhedrin and the temple necessarily wanted Jesus gone wasn't just because he was a rabble rouser, but it was because those big red words and words like what are in the Gospel of Thomas and what you break down in your book, The Nucleus, are quite literally the teachings of the high priests. He was teaching the sacred concept of direct communication with the divine to the common man, the secrets of the priests of Levi, you know, and the of Melchizedek, the ones that wore the chest plate that were allowed to touch the Holy of Holies. That's who you brought your sacrifice to be burned, you know, and without that sacrifice, money doesn't come into the temple.
You got it. I knew that word money was going to come up.
Well, that's why he was turning the tables over, folks. You know, was because it was the money for the burnt offerings and the fact of, look at this fallacy that you are propping up because you do not need this to communicate with the divine. You are divine.
You are so right. Money has nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Your communication is directly between you and the divine, and the divine is everywhere.
And it's interesting because once again, a lot of these teachings, It's what the Sanhedrin wanted swept under the rug that was coming out of Christ's mouth. And whenever you're talking about, I'm sorry, folks, even the Big C Catholic Church, I love you. but they I'm not going to say that they're 100% enlightened, but they're way more enlightened than they were when they like excommunicated Galileo. All right. Let's just go that far.
Well, they apologized.
Excommunicated him. You know, like they unlocked a box and like released his soul to heaven. Like what's that about? But in all sincerity, it's the fact of these teachings have been out there for years. And it's very interesting when you start getting into the missing 12 years of Christ because the last time we saw him, Mary and Joseph lost him.
Exactly.
He was at the temple. For some reason, the high priests were listening to him, even though he wasn't declaring like, hey, I'm the son of God, you know, which if he was an advanced Kabbalistic student at the age of 12, 13, pretty advanced in his yeshiva school or something like that, in his shiva, he could have very well had the ear of the high priest teaching for an afternoon, you know. So the idea of where he goes from that point until we see him in the river again at 33, there is a, or not 33, 30, 30. Sorry.
Roughly 30, maybe yeah. 29. We don't know.
Probably closer to 28, something like that. He probably had a good three and a half years of ministry before things went horribly awry. But in that time, that is a long time to craft these messages, to craft this very, very in-depth spiritual message once again that's being transmitted to everyday people, Wallace.
In my world, it subtracts somewhat that we don't have these missing years. We know virtually nothing about him as a child, and then we know nothing about him in the formative years, you know, up until the time he started to preach. And that's very concerning to me now. And I honestly believe he did some traveling, and he might have even gone to India.
That is what people have said for years. India, possibly Tibet, especially. And, you know, once you start getting into Indian culture, there is a story right up along the same timeline of a man coming over there about that age and staying about that long. And it's pretty remarkable because there is a ton of that teaching in the words. And what I love is that your book, and not just this book, because your other books, Crossing the Crevasse, things like that, they have a compendium of these, books of the, oh my God, of the Apocrypha. My God, Apocrypha almost didn't come out of my mouth there, Wallace.
I make a point to in the appendix on the three books that I have written to put three or four books that people may not be aware of, you know, in the appendix. And some of them are definitely Gnostic, and some I wanted to prove some alternate points with, such as the Assumption of Moses.
Yep. And I was going to say, one of the big reasons to group these four together specifically is because they cover that gap. They cover that span of time where these teachings came about, where this story of how a 12-year-old kid became the equivalent of the savior of mankind, you know, in that sacrificial way. And why somebody would even consider doing that. You know, whether you buy into the belief of Christ's divinity or not, that is your own personal belief, folks. I'm pretty sure I woke up in America this morning. So you're allowed to believe anything you want. I'm Catholic. We believe some crazy things. but these four gospels specifically that you've tied together. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Mary, especially the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Judas. Those are two that do go into the early childhood of Christ, you know, where you start hearing stories of, and I believe it's the Gospel of Mary where he's making the clay dove and blows life into it, and it comes to life while he's talking with his friends.
It flies.
You know, things like that, where like you're meeting this 13-year-old Jesus who's like Hey, wow, check this out, kids. Watch this. Nothing in my hands. I'm going to make a dub. Whew. And like is showing off his salvific powers to his friends because he's discovered them, you know, and really gets into a lot of that. Yes. Very human quality that you have to explore. And it's interesting that he even explores that. The idea of like using your power, using your talents to lash out at people. You know, things like that, or to show off and show that you're something different or something better. It's very interesting even to think about that in a psychological way, Wallace.
You know, for me now, I'm just open to all the religions that are out there. Yeah. I see, you know, facets of truth in them all.
Yeah.
And even with Christianity, you know, it's funny on how that even spread. A lot of the places where Christ went and preached today in some of these countries, such as Turkey, for example, 0% Christianity, and that's rounded off. It's something like 0.3%.
Yeah.
People call themselves Christians. And you look, Turkey had 5 of the 7 churches in Revelation, for example. That's where the Apostle John retired, and so forth. And Christianity really just did not catch hold around the Levant where Christ was. It caught hold when, you know, the population moved up through Europe and came west over to the United States. That's when it kind of caught hold. But it, you know, in the Middle East where they were, it did not catch hold. It's basically Muslim and or Hinduism, with some Buddhism and a little bit of Zoroastrianism still left and some Jainism, but not a whole lot of Christianity.
Well, and you know, even the concept of the call of the apostles and the sending them forth with message, you know, and
sometimes I think that was a little tweaking by the church to help them gain a little power.
And you know, it's very interesting to me, and it always has been, especially as a Catholic. Man, we read a lot of Paul. Yeah, and don't get me wrong, Paul wrote a lot.
He did. He did. In fact, if I went to a church today and the church existed, I would go to a Marcionite church. Mm. I would be a believer of Marcion of when he, you know, he had the first Bible back around 135, 140 AD, called the Testamentum. That's who I would probably go to. And if a UU church, a Universalist Unitarian church was here in my locale, that's probably where I would attend today. But they don't exist here in the Bible Belt where I'm at. Well, I would have to travel about an hour to get to one.
Yeah. And it's one of those, it's interesting that we read so much Paul when Peter was, well, the rock upon which the church was built. Mm-hmm. And I understand the whole cycle of ABC cycle of the liturgy and go to church every day and for 3 years and ABC, you'll get back to cycle A and you will have literally read the entire Bible beginning to end if you go to church every day, folks.
And that does nothing for you. But that literally does nothing for you.
Well, what's interesting is that when you start looking at the readings of Peter versus the readings of Paul, which are very judgmental, that's where we get a lot of the hellfire, damnation, things like that, is from Paul, not from Peter. When we read the words of Peter, they very much echo the words of the Gospel of Thomas in the idea of brotherly love and going forth to take care of each other and things like that. And it's interesting to see that because one of them was, of course, direct disciple. The other was inspired disciple. Pretty interesting
for me, though, the upper levels that Jesus taught really was teaching the individual to go inside, to learn who they are, to learn about the ego, to learn about the soul, to learn that they are as he is or was a little God, and that we are children and that we can grow up. And the way to do that is increasing your consciousness. And you do that in my world by learning to control the ego and that type thing. And that's really heavy duty spirituality, which was really what Jesus was trying to teach. But hardly any of that made it into the Bible.
Yeah.
And our modern day churches do not teach that. They teach that you need Christ to save yourself. That, you know, if you haven't accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you're probably going to hell and burn up, you know, places where you can't even buy an air conditioner.
Yeah.
But I fell into that philosophy for a long time. I just don't subscribe to that anymore. I'm almost to the point where we save ourselves, and we save ourselves through wisdom and knowledge, and we save ourselves by following the teachings of Christ.
Well,
and those teachings are that goods, material items, all things of that nature, including money, that does nothing for you. There's nothing. It's nothing but distractions.
Yeah.
We need to focus on our internal selves, learning who we are, increasing our consciousness, realizing who we are, our place in the universe, and grow in from inside. And that's something, you know, the churches today just don't teach. They don't teach that.
Well, and granted, you know, I will tell you right now, as somebody who taught CCE for many years, things like that, Wallace, my class was definitely different than the ones around me. My seventh graders were learning a few different things than the ones in the classrooms on either side that were working out. Out of the workbook, you know. And it would be interesting because my philosophy of teaching was very much this. Like, no, we'll talk about the three readings from church, but then we're going to talk about how those things make sense to a seventh grader in their world. You know, there is no use to give them anything that will mire them down, make them disinterested, or that is not applicable in their life as a seventh grader. Zero need. At that point, I'm a babysitter. You know, give me friggin' a Teddy Ruxpin, man. You know. If that's what you want for your seventh graders, for them just to do some book work, you know, like that, you want to know why they don't like coming to CCE. They do book work all day in English. That's why they don't want to come and talk and do more book work. You know, I realize it makes your job as a teacher easy.
They pretty much all do, you know, it's the same thing,
but
it's the same dogma that's been in existence for 1800 years.
Exactly.
And I don't subscribe to that any longer. I believe that you can, you know, feed the hungry and clothe the poor and do good deeds and do to others as you wish them, you know, to do to you, and learn to meditate. That's something else, you know, today's church doesn't do. We're taught to pray, and we're taught that our faith is really our connection to God, and how strong that connection is. For me now, faith is something completely different. Faith is actually power to me, such as levitation.
Mm.
That is faith. That is putting faith into practice. Moving a mountain with a mustard seed, we don't know anybody that's been able to do that. But that is faith to me. And I think we have faith labeled incorrectly.
Yes.
We think of faith as being like a conduit to God, and the better conduit we have, the harder we pray, the more that God knows us and knows us by name, the closer he is to us, the more power we'll get from God. But for me now, that power actually comes from us, from within.
Yep.
So it's something completely different. So I'm learning to meditate, and that's something that you can grab from the Far Eastern traditions. Again, the church doesn't teach. It's really taking everything that's out there, everything, and bringing it in instead of taking yourself and putting it out to God. It's almost like a reverse scenario. And in doing so, you really become humbled, and you really know who you are and what you've done right and what you've done wrong and what you need to do. And it's really cemented in your soul, and you really just don't get that you know, from what I've been through in my, you know, conservative Methodist background and Southern Baptist background.
Yeah, that's meditation, chakra alignment, things like that are things to be heavily avoided in in most of the deep right side of Christendom.
Yeah, I couldn't even say I was a little God in the Southern Baptist Church, or I would have been excommunicated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, and quite literally, you know, because those things are the gateway for the devil, you know, and I recently had a conversation with a very good friend of mine, about faith and the understanding that no, faith has nothing at all to do with the divine. Like my faith has to do with what I know my connection to the world around me is. And like yes, that is like because that is because I am divine.
I like that.
That is because I am divine, not because I have a connection to the divine, but because I am divine. And my faith is how much I know I can do.
Bingo.
Period.
I honestly believe that. You hit the nail on the head again.
Even the idea, Wallace, of taking the Lord's name in vain. You know, let's explore this concept real quick within the idea of the big red words here, you know, where we're talking about you are a little God. You know, one of the things we talk about regularly on the show is the idea that creation was spoken into being, and we as at least within the Judeo-Christian sense and within the sense of the Kabbalah, which, you know, we know Christ was at least exposed to, at the very least, within his Judaic tradition. So God breathed life into being, and he specifically amongst all creation breathed into us, which means that we have that same spirit to create by word, by vibration. We are vibration. By all ninth grade science, we are 90% empty space. We are a conscious vibration. And when you choose to vibrate higher, you'll shed your mortal coil and move on to another dimension. Like that, that's how that works. That's physics.
You're right up my alley.
So it's, and that's something that we discuss on the show regularly. Now, marrying that with the idea of taking the Lord's name in vain. Where I come with that is the idea that, you know, if you're asking God to do something for you, you had all creative power in the world to do whatever you needed to do. You shouldn't be to take care of whatever you need. But if you're asking him to, like, oh, God, please help me do this because you didn't do your side of things, that is directly taking the Lord's name in vain, because you're asking him to move a mountain that you didn't even prep to be moved, Wallace. You didn't even do your work on the side of the mathematic equation of power moving in the universe to prepare God to be able to help you.
You're preaching to the choir.
So, and it's interesting because this idea is once again one that No Christian church that I know of would be out there touting from the pulpit, Wallace. Mm.
True. Christ was a being of light. I want to touch on this. You know,
please,
he transfigured.
Please.
He transfigured,
yes,
more than once, by the way. Only one little snippet of a transfiguration made it into the Bible. But we are beings of light as well. We create photons when we pray and when we meditate. And the higher one's consciousness is, the more photons you create. And that's where I'm fully aware that I am a little God. I'm just a babe. And one of the tenets of the early church, as I'm sure you're aware of, is reincarnation, origin. Who at one time was thought to have the brightest mind the early church ever had, definite proponent with his Greek influence of reincarnation. And that accepted in the early church.
Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, it was a pillar of ancient Judaism.
There's no way we're going to grow up in this one lifetime. And I say that for 99.9% of us.
Yeah.
But life continues on. What makes Christopher, and what makes Wallace, we carry on. There is no death. There is no time. I mean, everything, a lot of what we've been taught is you know, to keep our minds narrow. We need to expand.
Yeah.
There is no time. So we can forget that. If there's no time, then we don't die, do we?
Thank you, Wallace. I have that discussion with people regularly. The idea that time in and of itself, like you go to the moon, time is different.
Sure. The faster you go,
time is relative to the observer.
This is even portrayed in some of the Egyptians in their history. Pharaohs would leave on a boat and come back. What happened is they came back 350 years later and no one knew them. I mean, time doesn't exist the way we know. We know that for a fact now.
Well, we
know it for a fact. It's Einstein's theory of relativity.
Yeah. Yeah. No, time is relative to the observer. And we decided, like, we decided 60 seconds was a minute.
You're exactly correct.
We decided that.
And it only works here on this one planet.
That's right.
Out of trillions and trillions trillions of planets.
Yeah.
It only works right here.
Yeah, what is universal central time? Like galactic central. What's galactic central time? Is that like plus 28 GMT? How's
Who
that
knows?
Work? You know, what's the time zone for that? What time does this show air at galactic central?
No.
You know,
I'm surely convinced that I was alive before I incarnated into this body. I may have even had a choice to the family I incarnated in and to the scenario environment that I incarnated in to work on some things I needed to work on. And I'm sure when I'll have a life review when I pass, I will incarnate into another body. It may not even be on this planet.
Yeah.
But I've got a lot to learn. It's a continual process. That's my world now.
Well,
and just to know that, you know, is a leap from what you've been taught, you know, in the past. But once you know that, it opens up a whole world of possibilities. You know, eventually one day you won't need to incarnate anymore. And that's what we're all really striving for, whether we know that or not.
Well,
and sooner or later, hopefully most of us will grow up.
Yes. Yes, exactly, Wallace. And you know, for those of you, don't get me wrong, Christians. Nobody is poo-pooing your tradition, your thought, things like that. But feel free to go back and, you know, read the teachings of Judaism, especially during the time of Christ. Once you get into traditional Judaism, things like that, the idea of reincarnation, especially corporeal reincarnation of a soul within the same familial line, is hugely, like, just an accepted thing.
Sure, it's the where Pharisees believed in reincarnation.
It's where the idea of sins of the fathers come from. The idea that you as a newborn can be stained with the sins of those who died before you. You know,
I put some of that in the nucleus.
And
look at Esau, for example.
That's why I wanted to get into it. We have you for about another 15-20 minutes here. So let's start exploring that, because I think that is one of the biggest bell ringers here in this work, Wallace, is the idea that what you've considered Christian for so long has really been tainted and pulled away from you by pulling these teachings away. You know, you're really getting a very one-sided, it's a beautiful gem, but you're only getting one side of it polished, you know? So it looks very different. So let's polish the other side a little bit and explore some of these other topics that Christians may not be familiar with, like reincarnation.
Definitely exist. You know, in the Southern Baptist tradition, it does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay if you point out that, you know, John the Baptist was actually Elijah. Well, that was a special case or a special situation. But as soon as you say that reincarnation exists, you know, you're looked at like you're not really one of us, are you? you're taught based on a phrase or two from Paul that you have this one life to live. But I view that as one life to live in this body. Without a doubt, this body will die once. It's a mere vessel, or if you will, and it will wear out. But what is inside continues on, without doubt. Clement of Alexandria believed that. Origen believed that. The early church believed that for 200 and some years.
Yep.
And it just got weeded out, and it's unfortunate. That happened, you know, without a doubt, if you read some of these Gnostic books that did not make it into the Bible, you'll certainly see that, including the Book of Thomas. And we go on. And the fact is that we are a son of God, just like Jesus Christ, a son of God. Jesus Christ is our mentor. He's our teacher. That's why he came here, to show us what we can be. And if we follow what he teaches, then we can be like that. So I look at Yeshua. I call him Yeshua because if you mentioned Jesus back then, no one would even know what you were saying. The J wasn't even invented until the King James. So his name was really Yeshua. But you know, if you followed his teachings, that's what we need to do. And that's what I subscribe to, are his teachings. Be kind to children. Be kind to your neighbor. Turn the other cheek. You're always going to have the poor, but if you want to, you know, take care of the poor, take care of the poor. And clothe those that need clothing. And take care of everyone, because we're all connected. We're all brothers and sisters. And when you look at someone, you're really looking at yourself. How can you say that you're better than the next person next to you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things you realize when you're able to do meditation and realize this soul that is within each of us. There's no way. And it's just the fact that thought even comes into your mind.
Yeah.
Is poison. So that's an area where we really have to improve. It's one thing, you know, you can say you're making a step in progress, not saying something, but what's up here and what you allowed to percolate, even though you didn't say it.
Yeah.
That's still something you need to work on, people. So we all have some issues.
We all have,
without a doubt, love.
Yes.
And I will say this on every program I'm on, is the key component of the universe. It's the integral thread that connects everything. And it's a love I honestly believe that is so great we can't even fathom it. It's an agape love.
Yes.
Or agape love that is so great.
Yeah.
That you know, we have a long way to go.
Yeah. No, no.
And I'm not afraid to go there, because we can go at our own pace.
Well, exactly. So, and we have to, Wallace, and we have to. The main thing is,
that's what makes it legitimate.
We've got to have patience and empathy with each other. And,
exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, you've brought up meditation numerous times. And I think aside from Christianity, whatnot, keeping some folk from meditation, I think the main issue is, and this is something that we discuss regularly on the show, we are living in a harried society and world, as opposed to even whenever I was a kid. I'm verging on 50. I'll be 49 this year. I remember a day and age where I had to go to the library to look something up. And if it wasn't in the card catalog or in the neighboring library's card catalog, I may not be able to get it, you know? And that world has sped up, man. Like, we wake up every day now with the news from Poughkeepsie in our face. It didn't used to be that way. So, The way that people process things, stuff like that is very, very much different. It's hard to slow down to begin with.
There are a lot of dangers in that too.
Much less in a fast paced world like what we live in now, to be able to slow down and get away from that, to be able to put the phone down and not worry about it.
You've got to do that. That's one of the components of, you know, efficient and proper meditation is to put all that stuff away. And that's something that's very, very hard to do.
Yeah.
You've got to put everything aside.
Yep.
And then you'll realize new truths like I have. But let me tell you, it has taken a long time even to get to what I would call first or second grade in meditation. It is an art and a science, but it requires the word that you mentioned, patience. A lot of patience. Sometimes my meditation fails. It's extremely difficult to do. And we have an extra hard time in this country because of what you mentioned. We have so many distractions.
Yep.
Are you getting 4 bars on your cell phone today?
Yeah.
You know, that type thing. And if you were out in the wilderness in a tent, you don't have those distractions.
Yeah.
So in many ways, society has gone backwards instead of forwards. And that's one of the ways I judge that. My comment is that we have all these things around us, and I'm not saying things are bad. Don't get me wrong.
No.
Don't want to ruffle too many feathers. It's just that when you have all these things, and here in this country, to have these things, a second house, a third car, a boat, a rare painting on your wall, that's a sign of success. And we all are trained in our mind to be successful in this country, but none of it means anything.
Yeah.
You can't take it with you. It means nothing. And the more of the stuff that you have requires more of your time to take care of it, to call it, to add to it, to worry about mites, rust, corrosion, theft. It is dangerous. It could take you down a road of destruction. And I realize that now, and I'm just as guilty as anyone else. You can see the stereo behind me. I can't take that with me. I love listening to my music, but it does nothing for me in the fact that it is teaching me anything. It is really just a physical a sensation for the here and now.
Yes. And you know, I will say this to anybody, and it took me years to understand it, you know, because I spent years working in churches, things like that. You know, I have a friend who's coming over in a little while, one of my best friends from high school, literally my best friend from high school. And, you know, even he used to ask me, like, dude, you spend like 30 hours a week at that church, man. Like, I didn't get paid for most of that work, you know, not for a good decade of that. That was all volunteer. And I was like, you know, I learned more about myself and my place in the universe from talking to those kids than they could ever learn from me.
The teacher learns more than the students. And when I taught Sunday school, I learned more than they did. Yeah. But just doing the homework, the study in preparation for teaching.
It's the idea, Wallace, that we need to be ready to move that forward. We need to be ready to be open-hearted to other people. There was a beautiful big red word phrase in the Bible about being supple as a willow. And I think way too many people, when it comes to their dogma, their doctrine, when it comes to what their church says, and I don't care if it's capital C Catholic, if it's, you know, Greek Orthodox or you know, Christian Unitarian, what have you. So many of them want to be an oak for their faith.
They're supposed to be a little bit different from the other 33,000 next to them.
But it's the fact of, like, you know, once again, remove the plank from your eye if you're trying to take care of somebody's splinter, all right? Number two, you're supposed to be a willow. You're supposed to be bending and moving with people, not rigid like an oak where you don't move and branches break because you don't know how to move in the wind the right way, you know, and that's just it. There is a beautiful balance. I remember my spiritual director from the seminary, Father Andy. Religion's a great thing when taken in moderation.
I love it.
Cistercian monk. Loved that man. But absolutely, absolutely, because beyond a certain point, it becomes fanaticism, Wallace. It becomes the fact of you do things without question. Because
it becomes a habit. It becomes a routine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's no longer an intention of what you're trying to do. It's the fact of you're doing it because you're told to do it, you know, and
then there's that underlying little phrase. If you don't do this, you're going to hell.
Yeah. Yeah. If not this, then that. And that's just it. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's because that's not my style of parenting, you know, but I also don't think that that's really God's style of parenting either. You know, I think he's a pretty let us learn our own lessons kind of person. And hey, like prime example, my son this last year got very, very upset with a kid in his class. He wasn't even seven yet, you know. Said something, immediately realized what he did. Now, this kid won an award from his principal as a proud father, I'm going to say it, for being the most open-hearted, kind kid in his first grade level. Now, he immediately realized what he did, broke down in tears, and started crying. Now, I was out of town. I got a text from my wife while I was driving for work. And she's like, do you want to talk to him? I was like, oh, no. You let him stew till I get back. He had done enough work on himself. When he saw me, he came up and was like, I've really been thinking about what I did. And it wasn't nice to my friend. Like, it wasn't fair to her. Like, he had already thought it through morally. Why? It's 6 years old. I didn't have to raise hand. I didn't have to raise my voice. It's amazing what you do when you give people the latitude.
That tells me a lot about the teacher.
Well, thank you. But it's the fact of, yeah, I could have followed the protocol of my family down the line. You know, I remember my mom, where's the corporal punishment form? Because you waste the teacher's time. I'll let them get a hold of you. Then I'll get a hold of you. And when your dad has his weekend, I'll make sure he knows what happened with both of us.
Well, what your son learned at that young age, I was in my 30s before I learned a lot of that. I mean, I've got a lot of things that I guess I could be sorry for that I'll need forgiveness for, which I know I will get forgiveness for. But it's taken me a long time to grow up and a long time to get to where I'm at now. It's just like I have been, you know, given a catalyst when I saw my craft back in 2016. It's sped things up for me to get to where I'm at today. And there again, it's been quite a ride. Let me say that. It was Reverend Michael Carter who told me I was on a spiritual path, and he was so correct.
Same.
And it has been a ride. And I feel now that I'm valid now, and I think that's the right word I would use is valid. I feel that I have a valid place in this universe that I don't think I realized that before.
That's beautiful.
And you can read a lot into that, what I just said, but validity is certainly a word that I would use now. If someone were to ask me what has changed, you know, in my life in the last, you know, 5, 6, 8 years.
Do you think that, because of course, like you said, your encounter with that craft catalyzed you into this world of Christianity and into this spiritual path? Do you think you would have come down this path?
I follow the teachings of Christ.
Sure.
But it's hard for me to label myself as being, you know, a Christian per se, based on what the typical definition of a Christian is, because of some of my external beliefs. I would be happy, just as happy almost now where I'm at, being a Hindu as I am a disciple of Christ, based on what I know of his upper level teachings. And I'll just let it go at that.
Well, no. And that's why I tell people on the show all the time, I'm a recovering Catholic, you know, because, hey, man, there's still parts of my faith, because once again, my faith is my confidence and my connection with the divine. No doubt about that. You know,
well, we probably differ on our definition of faith, and I certainly respect your definition. I know that my definition of faith includes what you have said, but it also includes my power component from within.
Oh no, absolutely. It's that power to create and manifest from the energy of the world around you, and from you being a part of that, a divine integral part of that. Without you and that vibration, the chord does not sound that is the universe. Period.
Everything is frequency and everything is vibration.
Yeah. Take a microtone out of a C chord and it really sounds weird, you know? And without all of our vibrations, like, energy isn't created or destroyed. It just changes form. So, you know, yeah. And that's just it. Those are the things that integrally make my faith and make me understand that I am a moving part of this universe, Wallace, and that I can move the universe. And that's a beautiful thing. I don't have to go into a building.
You are a child of the universe too.
Yeah.
And let's go back to something you mentioned was one of those first synods where we came up with the Apostles' Creed. Mm. There's one phrase in there which to this day just astounds me, that Jesus Christ, the only Son of God.
Yeah.
Now, I fell for that for 60 years. I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe it's biblical. And I'm just as much a son of God as he is. He's just higher up than I am.
Yeah. Yeah. As
otherwise, why did he come here to teach us? It'd be a futile attempt.
Yes. Yes, exactly. In that ascended master way, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, and that's just it. Understanding the fact that there's levels to this game, just like there's levels of involvement
Bingo.
To the world around us.
There's levels in what we can screw as heaven.
That's
read the
right.
Book of Enoch.
And you choose your level of involvement. This is literally spiritual fight club, folks, as much as I hate to tell you. You choose your level of involvement. If suddenly one day your eyes are peeled open, never forget, it's probably because you chose not to look, you know?
And once your eyes are peeled open, it's like Oliver Wendell Holmes. Once the mind had expanded, you never go back.
That's right. That's right.
To the Wallace, original shape.
Wallace, thank you so much, man. We have you for about another 5 minutes. Wrapping things up, what can people do if they have followed this path, if they have come to this realm of knowledge that you have, and with this book and with your other books that really get into this esoteric teaching that was removed from the Bible, how can they start to open somebody's mind to it? Because it can be like trying to pry open a monkey's hand to get the peanut, man. It can be hard
to
open
very
somebody's
careful.
Mind.
Please. You've got to be very careful, because you can alienate people instantly. You've got to do it with patience. I know we've used that word already multiple times on this program, but it is a key word, patience. And you've got to bring yourself, put yourself on their level of thinking. You've got to make yourself compatible with them and then ease into it. You just can't come out and say, You know,
yeah,
my book shows you 30 examples of UFOs in the Bible, and David communicated with his God who was actually in a UFO. If you start down that road, you're probably going to turn them off initially. For me, I did my own backup and study, and it took that craft being right over my head to do that, or I wouldn't be here talking with you right now.
Yeah.
But when I backed up and did the studies for myself, you know, I realized that the Bible is chock full of these crafts. You realize that we've never been alone. Even Josephus, the famed historian from, you know, back in the days of Christ, really, or close to that, Jewish, but he saw things in the sky. He wrote about sky armies. We've never been alone. And these crafts just didn't start with Roswell. They've been all the way thousands of years before Christ, all the way up to today. Yeah. And for me, and I'm speaking for myself, these crafts were definitely here all throughout the Old Testament. And I write a lot about this. So that was the opening path for me to realize an opening or a crevice, if you will, expansion of my narrow thought and reality than what I had to something much larger now. Yeah. And you know, once that happens, you never go back to where you were, for one thing. And then you realize that you're a part of this universe that we're talking about. You and I are connected. You and I are brothers. You and I are an integral part of this universe. And your thought waves and my thought waves, everything we think, because it is energy. When you think, it's energy, and you're creating photons, it goes out into space. And you are actually a part of this reality, each of us. So the question is, are you adding or are you subtracting?
Yeah.
And it's like, are you edifying or are you bringing down? You want your thoughts to be positive.
Yeah.
You want your thoughts to be pure. And you want your actions to go along with that. And I think that's the goal for all of us, whether we acknowledge it, you know, or not. It's up to the individual on how to get there. The church has their way of teaching you, and that may work for some, but it's a very narrow path, as you and I know. But the key thing is to find yourself. I know that may sound a little flaky, but
you know,
there's a lot of truth to that. Find yourself, seek yourself, learn who you really are.
Yeah. Yeah. Could not have said that better myself. Wallace, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your work into these, because, you know, you find a lot of translations of these gospels, but you don't find a lot of people who are really breaking them apart like a Bible study. and you do a great job of doing that. So if you are I'll tell you right now, folks, if you are a staunch hardcore Christian and anything we've said tonight sparks a fire inside of you, all right, go have it refined. Go visit otherflocks.net. That is Wallace's website. That's where you can get the nucleus. That's where you can get within grasp. That's where you can get beyond the crevasse. These things are beautiful, folks. It's great to see somebody really breaking these down in this spiritual way, and not just in a scholarly, you know, breaking the Assyrian down, things like that. So Wallace, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
You are very, very welcome. I have totally enjoyed it. Thank you,
absolutely.
Chris.
We've once again got to have you on again and again. It's always great.
Peace and love to you.
Same to you, my friend. Take care. Hold the line real quick while we go out to this commercial break. While you are online checking out everything from W. Wallace Wagner on otherflocks.net, make sure to stop on by amazon.com. That is where you can find his new book, The Nucleus. You can also find his new book right on CuriousRealm.com/store. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can go to find all of the books, everything from all of our guests, all of their classes, things like that. When we come back from this commercial break, we will have more great conversation with great topics right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. W. Wallace Wagner is an amazing guest. I love chatting with him. His realm of knowledge into the world of Apocrypha and the world of books that have been removed from the Bible, specifically the teachings of the Gospel of Thomas, are amazing. Our guest in this segment is a good friend of the show. He is the author of Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. He is also the gentleman who runs the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, and he has a new book out called Pharaoh's Pump Analyzed. It is an ebook available on Amazon right now. You can find it on his website, thepump.org. You can also find it, of course, on CuriousRealm.com. Welcome back to the show, researcher Stephen Myers. How are you?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me back on your show. I'm honored.
It is always great having you on. I love our conversations because I find it interesting how many people believe that we had to have had intervention from outside to build the pyramids and don't get me wrong, very well may have happened. Who knows? Who gave us the realm of knowledge, but the fact that the technology existed to do it, the fact that the ingenuity existed to do it, I believe is fully there. And you have been, especially with the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, on this course for a long, long time. Tell us, how did you get into this realm of research to begin with, Stephen?
Well, I've always been interested in technology. My background and degrees are related to technical subjects. And I'm a ham radio operator and have the FCC commercial class radio telephone license.
Oh, wow.
And on and on. Well, and I also like history. So if you like history and technology, there's a good chance you'll be interested in the Great Pyramid. It's a 45-story skyscraper that was built in ancient times. So it's quite interesting. So it became an interest and then a hobby and then ultimately a life quest to understand how the Great Pyramid was assembled and why. And ultimately we established a nonprofit foundation as a vehicle or catalyst to pursue the direction of interest we're following.
And that direction of interest specifically is why we have you on the show, because once again, there have been numerous hypotheses out there for years with Egyptologists as far as the construction of the Great Pyramid. Everything from spiral ramps on the inside of the pyramid to ramps that extend out for a mile and a half to once again, even aliens popping out of the sky and showing people how to build a pyramid. Not necessarily from Egyptologists, but from ancient alien theorists. But the hypothesis that you have, seems to be more and more supported by the science that comes out, Stephen, which is the idea of flooding the area and using water locks.
Yes. We contend that the Great Pyramid was built using water locks and barges. And my first book is about that. And the recent discovery of a branch of the Nile that follows along the quite close to the pyramids is sort of an indicator that there's a profound link between the Great Pyramid and water. So water locks are the system of choice, even in the 21st century, to move our heaviest objects. And we think that in ancient times, the original builders were geniuses and used water locks to move their most heaviest payloads on barges and move them effortlessly.
Well, and you know, especially whenever you look at the area, it is adjoining the Nile River. It's right there. That is what the big discovery from space was that we had up on screen, was the fact that there is actively a branch of the Nile River, and not like a small branch of the Nile River, a very large branch of the Nile River that has been discovered from space.
Yes. People before this discovery would say, well, it's a dry desert. How did they get water over there? And now we have the answer. Certainly, there were a lot of indicators that there is a link between water and the Great Pyramid before this discovery. But this discovery of this waterway, it says on the screen there, mm-hmm. was kind of a confirmation of at least a part of our direction of research and about how the original builders were geniuses. So they used that branch of the Nile to move stones on barges effortlessly to the building site. So I think it's real interesting, and it's been kind of a vindication and a validation of what we're trying to follow to understand what the geniuses did back in ancient times.
Well, precisely, because it really doesn't make sense. I mean, they were, once again, absolute geniuses when it comes to building. I mean, not just the pyramids, when you look at their statuary, when you look at other temples like Karnak, places like that, they are huge on massive scale. And there was even an article out of BBC not too long ago, with a scientist who has a hypothesis that the empty part of the pyramid was basically used like a very large water elevator to basically hollowed out. You'd push it in there and the water would push it up, like a water lift to get it up to the level that you're working on. And move it into place. So almost the same hypothesis that you're working on, except for going from inside the pyramid outward instead of flooding the space.
Yeah, there's a whole host of researchers with various ideas, configurations, but they all have an idea that the Great Pyramid was built with the use of water and the buoyancy of water to help move the stones, instead of what Egyptologists said about the workers had really strong back muscles and they drug the stones and they were happy to do it. So no, it's some sort of a relationship between water and buoyancy, water locks, and the ancient geniuses who built such a structure. On screen now, you're showing just a small portion of our video series we have on our website, which is free, about how the Great Pyramid was assembled. So we have that video series and also another video series about why it was assembled, why they went to such an effort to build that massive structure.
Well, and let's start exploring that a little bit. Yeah, I'll play some of this video that kind of explains the possibility of using water locks to get things into position. Why build this? Because, you know, we've talked regularly on the show with you and without you, Stephen, about the fact of it's obviously, at least to me, by all traditional Egyptology that we know, that is not a tomb. I'm sorry, whoever they were burying in there, they had zero intention of them ever seeing the afterlife. If that was the case, there's no sacred script. There's no writings from the Book of the Dead for the soul to be measured by, anything like that. So the idea of the king's chamber being a tomb to me is just out there when it comes to traditional Egyptology and what we know religiously.
Yeah, it's a falsehood. Egyptology is a science that's promoting this falsehood, a narrative that was created in the 18th century or whatever, that about the big ramp and all of that. But how do long open passages and sliding stones protect a pharaoh's carcass? And no answer is ever given for that. So It's just what Egyptologists have been told. And that's what they're told to believe, and they believe it, and they're going to tell the next generation that same worn out story that they've come up with. But the purpose of the Great Pyramid had to be at least as big as the cost of the construction.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It had to have a big return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
All of that energy and expense and cost for years had to have a return on investment. You know, we could build, let's say, the Hoover Dam. All right. We could build the Hoover Dam and it could point to stars. Well, that's a pretty small return on investment. That would be stupid.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it does have passages that point to stars. But we think that the Great Pyramid was a working machine, that it actually did something. And what it did was it pumped water, and that pumped water provided prosperity for those who built it. Just as people now eat apples that are irrigated using hydroelectricity from these dams. You know, we are inundated by that type of prosperity, but the ancient people built their system, their water pumping system, to provide prosperity for themselves. So it is a fantastic structure, and an ancient but high technological machine to help them in their civilization, and that high technology can help us in our modern but very troubled world.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, we know that the valley was once extraordinarily rich with crop, things like that. It was very much a different locale at that point.
Yeah, it was like a breadbasket of the world. And even in ancient times, a yearly inundation is not enough water to farm year round.
Mm.
And in modern times, the people in the Valley of the Nile built the largest water pump in the world, the Mubarak pumping station. And it pumps water out of the Nile River. People say, well, they already got water right there. Why do they need a water pump? Well, they do. That's why they built the largest water pump in the world, the Mubarak pumping station. And in ancient times, they built the largest water pump in the world at the time, the Great Pyramid water pump, and provided prosperity for generations. Big return on investment.
Well, and let's get into the operating principle here. I brought up some of the video here from your series about the Great Pyramid water pump. Let's start getting into the theory of operation and how this actively worked, Stephen.
Okay. Water entered the Great Pyramid water pump through the upper end of the descending passage, and it went down into the subterranean chamber. And it's not an unfinished chamber. It's completely finished. even though it's irregular on the far end of it, if you will, there's humps. But we think those humps were used to employ the power of implosion that Victor Schrauberger used in modern times. He is a researcher in Germany and Austria, you know, pre-World War II, and determined that water had a property known as implosion and usually associated with whirlpools and vortex movement. So anyway, that all of that helped water move up the passage through the interior of the Great Pyramid to the lower end of the Grand Gallery. And in the upper end of the Grand Gallery, they created a vacuum by separating the hydrogen and oxygen from the water through electrolysis. So those two gases, when mixed, are quite volatile.
Yep.
And when that mixture of gases is ignited, it ultimately creates a vacuum. You can see a lot of experiments on YouTube that show that a powerful vacuum is created. That vacuum moves that massive piston of water in the Grand Gallery up, if you will. Mm. Water coming in from the bottom and the vacuum in the top moves water up in the Grand Gallery higher. Well, the vacuum is released through a valve mechanism and timing to push water down into the Queen's Chamber and ultimately compress air in the upper half of the Queen's Chamber. And then that compressed air pushes water up into the Grand Gallery, excuse me, up into the King's Chamber,
yep.
and then out the King's Chamber vents. So they use a force of compressed air twice, once in the Queen's Chamber and once in the King's Chamber. But it's quite complicated, but we have a whole video series free to the public to watch to find out the details of how that water pumping system worked.
Well,
so it's a fascinating and amazing, and I hope people watch that video series.
It is an awesome video series, and I remember years ago you actively sent me DVDs of it, and I love the fact that it is all available online. It's all, yeah, I mean, you can find it all at thepump.org, but it's all available on YouTube, things like that as well. And when you start looking specifically at places like the King's Chamber itself, once again, that large sarcophagus in the King's Chamber, which is cracked, broken. And it would take a lot to crack such a piece of granite. That is some thick granite that is solidly carved. And when you start looking around and seeing what look like burn marks, soot marks, things like that in the King's Chamber, the presence of what could be, once again, micro explosions, things like that, which were being used to pull up the water and create the vacuum for the pump, much like basically like a one cylinder engine, you know,
very much so. Or almost more like a compound steam engine in a boat. You know, they would have three cylinders and each one would be bigger than the next. And they would use the compressive force of the steam three times over and make it more efficient. The King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber do that in a very similar way. First, a smaller chamber and then a bigger chamber to reuse the force of compressed air to make the water pumping system quite efficient. So,
yeah.
So there's a lot of direct physical evidence that seems to corroborate this interpretation of that evidence.
Yeah, and it does not take, just for all of you out there thinking like, oh, well, you know, it takes a crazy amount of power to electrolyze water. No, it does not. It does not take a whole lot of power. It takes no more power than it does to electroplate gold. To electrolyze water and separate hydrogen and oxygen. And we happen to know that, well, the Egyptians electroplated gold. We know that, you know, so.
Yeah, they were geniuses in many ways. There's the Baghdad Battery.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
stone-cutting methods that are beyond compare and on. So they had lathes, metal working, glass working, a whole host of other things. Supposedly, a dagger in the King Tut's tomb was from a meteorite, and on and on. So there's nothing at all primitive about the ancient people in the Valley of the Nile.
No. And that's just it. While they may have lived in what we would consider a simpler time, they were far advanced past us in many, many ways. They were not dealing with things like dust bowls and demineralized earth at that point. You know, that took tens of thousands of years and a change in the course of the Nile to happen. So the fact that they were living in what is geologically a different area and once again had access to technologies, had access to moving parts and electrolysis, things like that. I will pop up on screen right now from Popular Mechanics, an article that came out all of last year, February of 2023, talking about physicists, get this, using a vacuum to create energy. So the idea of possibly using the vacuum created in the Great Pyramid itself for pumping water to create energy while doing that, you know.
I think they were sophisticated in a way that it's hard for us to understand because our technologies seem to be very harmful to the world around us. You know, oil spills,
very impactful,
damming rivers and pollution, but they were more in harmony, I think, with the world around them, with their environment, and their technology improved their environment, which is the opposite of us. So, so we have a lot to learn from the ancient geniuses, and hopefully we can redevelop some of those ancient high technologies to replace the technologies that we've come up with.
Yeah, no, precisely. And I mean, even whenever you look at ancient civilizations in the Amazon, things like that, Stephen, they were once again far less impactful to the environment around them whenever they built. You know, Teotihuacan didn't destroy the area, and it's got like a river of mercury under it, and they didn't destroy the area around it. You know, it was fertile and multiplied, and they had terra preta. You know, like they created soil that is still more plentiful than the soil around it.
Yeah. They were impactful to the environment, but the impactful effect was positive.
Yes.
Which is phenomenal to think about in our future or in our world of the technology we've chosen. But in South America, they had medicines. They had transportation. They had bridges. They had economic trade networks and everything else. Nothing's primitive about them.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we're more primitive than they are. And what we've done is we've developed technologies that are polluting, but also they are concentrated into the control of a few people.
Yeah.
You know, pollution is a proof that somebody made money. Okay.
Oh, sure. No, that is. And in some
the
equation.
High price of gasoline when you go to the pump is good for somebody.
Yeah.
Not us, but it is good for somebody. And the somebody that it's good for is who's controlling the type of energy that we use. But the Great Pyramid is like the Tesla Tower in a way. In this regard, there's no meter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just making energy.
Well, pumping
water and whatever.
And once it's going, it's kind of got that Stirling engine concept where it feeds itself and it keeps going. You know,
it does.
Until the cycle is stopped.
The details of that is in my book, my second book and all of them. So there's a lot of details, a whole body of research regarding all of that, you know, two DVDs out we were selling on Amazon.
Yep.
But a lot of people in the third world who need this type of technology couldn't afford to buy DVDs from the West, if you will. So we, as a nonprofit foundation, made the information on those DVDs free to anyone, you know, with a computer. So on YouTube and other places.
Yeah. Like I said, I love the fact that you guys have gone through and put all of that up and made it publicly available in that kind of way. Because it is remarkable to look at in the realm of research, the idea that, religiously, what have you, a society would be moved to do something like this. However, when you're talking long-term benefit, like you're saying, it's much more of an in sum game than just a religious center, you know? There's a whole lot of evidence to show that there was a whole lot of religion going on in the Great Pyramid, that there were a whole lot of ceremonies happening in the Great Pyramid or anything like that.
Yeah, there's not much of that. There's no like religious paraphernalia. There's no religious writing, like you say, no Book of the Dead,
no body,
no pyramid text associated with the Great Pyramid itself, and that type of thing. But it's such a huge construction project that it would have to have a huge return on investment. You know, we built our highway system, which is, that infrastructure, huge return on investment. If you ever order something from Amazon, you need to appreciate that. And our power grids, even our sewer system, all of our infrastructure provides huge return on investment. So that's what we think the Great Pyramid was. So another thing to consider, if somebody says, well, gives you a reason for the Great Pyramid, but it doesn't provide a huge return on investment, that would mean their reason that they've come up with is incorrect.
Yeah.
And I think pointing to stars is a very small return on investment for such a big structure.
Yeah. Yeah. That is one of my favorite things about you on social media is your Orion correlation theory posts. Because we tend to get stuck in ruts of thinking, and those thinkings aren't always fully logical, Stephen. And the idea of correlation is not causation should be the first words trumpeted from every mountain whenever it comes to investigating anything like this, is that correlation is not causation. Just because something looks like something doesn't mean that it was utterly made for that purpose. Could the pyramids have been aligned to Orion's belt in an homage to something that, means to a lot of societies, something major? When you watch Orion, you're watching the passage of specific seasons, which are typical for hunting, planting, things like that. So even the idea of Orion the hunter being a guide for when to put crop in the ground, what have you, because it's in the air, that would be a good reason to shape something that's helped plant and pump water for the plants in that kind of way.
Well, they were able to determine that type of information or a calendar with Stonehenge. So Stonehenge is quite a bit smaller project than the Great Pyramid. So, but the Great Pyramid is the center point or subject of two competing correlation theories. The first one is all of those precise Great Pyramid Bible correlations that were quite popular not long ago.
Yep.
And the second is the correlations made up by the Orion correlation theory. And they both use the same invalid research methods and very shoddy research that they're both founded on. And currently, the first correlation theory, the biblical correlation theory, has already been rejected by everyone except religious zealots. based on its poor research that created that theory. And we're going through the same process right now with the Orion correlation theory. It's being rejected more and more by people who look at how the foundation of how that theory was created.
Yeah. And you know, even just considering it, Stephen, I don't know that there could be a more hotly debated structure as far as its history and its construction. You know, even the Acropolis, things like that. Like we have documents about when it was built, things like that. Yeah. Like we have almost nothing about the Great Pyramid. We have almost, we have a little bit about its construction, things like that. Nothing as far as like, here's schematic, nothing as far as like, here's the social plan from society to put it together.
Yeah. No videotapes, no photographs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Great Pyramid is the most hotly debated structure on Earth. More books have been written about the Great Pyramid than any other building on Earth.
Well, and until probably 75 years ago, the going theory, even from the time of Napoleon, the Napoleonic discoveries, all that kind of stuff there, even into the time of, correct me if I'm wrong, Sir Edmund Hillary, is that correct? Even up to that point, it was the fact that slaves built the Great Pyramid. We now know that to be a falsehood, an utter falsehood, you know.
Well, to me, how the Great Pyramid was built, what the workers did, is certainly much more interesting than their citizenship status.
Sure.
So, like a cotton gin, you know, they before the Civil War, they had this machine Eli Whitney made. And the slaves would turn the crank. It would separate the seeds from the cotton, if you will. Yep. But I'm interested in how the cotton gin worked, not who turned the crank, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So my point is, a free man can turn the crank, and the technology is the same. So if the workers were slaves, which they weren't,
no,
or not, it doesn't really matter. When people start talking about the citizenship status of the workers, then as being significant, then then they're starting to blow smoke.
Well, and
you know, there's such a thing as a wage slave. You know, yes. I worked in a factory for quite a while. I was a wage slave.
Yeah, yeah.
You work and you get a little bit of money to have a place to sleep. You know, so
the company store.
Workers, you know, they probably got paid pretty good.
Yep.
You know, it was a good gig, good and easy work.
Well, and also it's the fact that the point I was making is the story of how the pyramids was built has changed numerous times just in our lifetime, you know, and the hypotheses of, once again, internal spiral ramps being there, all kinds of things. The actual fact is, once you get past the external casing stones, it's a jumble of rocks, man.
Oh, it is.
There is beautiful internal structure, things like that. You know, once again, the chambers, all that kind of stuff, very, very expertly made, the tunnels to them, but everything piled up around that until the casing stones, pretty much a pile. It's just a pile. It's not every stone in an imperfect precision layer where you can't fit a playing card between it. And that's what people misunderstand. They think that every stone in the Great Pyramid is precision placed, and it's not.
It's not. No, it's they usually call it the rough interior.
Yeah.
It is quite rough. Gaps between the stones, you know, inches of gaps, if you will. But there's varying degrees of precision which lend credence to the idea that it's a machine. A water pump on a car, I don't know if you ever worked on cars, but they're usually cast iron, and the cast iron part is pretty rough, except for where it seals onto the next engine and it's machined smooth. So different degrees of precision relate to different aspects of any machine, if you will. You know, the 2x4s in my house are a lot rougher and less precise than the glass in my house, the glass windows. So precision is an indicator of, technological purpose, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. The inner working parts, the parts that needed to be precise, were precise. Everything that kept those parts under pressure, everything that kept those parts in place, we don't need it to be quite as precise. You know, once we get to the exterior casing of it, we're going to need it to be precise again. But in order to attain that resonance, things like that, what you need is the mass of the stones. You don't necessarily need every stone to be precision in place for that to happen.
Right. There's a lot going on inside the Great Pyramid, and it needed to be very strong, if you will. A lot of forces, vacuum, pressure, the kinetic energy of moving water. So that justifies this great big massive structure, kind of like hydroelectric dams are often quite large and thick because it justifies a technological requirement.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to think about the Great Pyramid in terms of technology, not, you know, what type of hat did the pharaoh wear, you know, or what did the hieroglyphs say? You know, there's no hieroglyphs on the Great Pyramid. Don't need it. And you don't have to worry about all these other things, the language they spoke and all of that. Yeah. And political issues or mummies, you know, if you want to understand the technology of this 45-story skyscraper, you can peel away all of that. You know, religion did not move the stones of the Great Pyramid. You know, correlations didn't move the stones. So you don't have to think about that. Language didn't move the stones. And the workers' political status didn't move the stones, and their love of the pharaoh didn't move the stones. You know, it was a technological requirement, and people will get off of that path and start talking about mummies and all of that when you ask them about how the Great Pyramid was built. And that means that they are blowing smoke.
And you know, once again, when you start talking about a structure of that size, you have to talk about its significance to the society and the reason that the society took such efforts to build something on such scale. And it's not like it's a temple or something like that, where it was an important religious center, you know. And it's not like it was a tomb, as stated so many times. Mm-hmm. So it had to have had another purpose. It had to have had another reason. And
And it had to be a big reason.
Yeah, precisely. So I think something along the lines of, like you're saying, being able to continuously pump water from the underground aquifer, things like that make much more sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. You know, all hydroelectric dams have passages that point to stars, but that doesn't mean there's a worldwide hydroelectric dam star correlation theory or anything.
Yeah. You know,
people haven't come up with that because it would be ridiculous. And I think people that think the Great Pyramid had any symbolism involved with it are just grasping at straws and using poor research methods to come up with a narrative, that type of thing. So, battleships, their cannons point to stars. So, but there's no relationship between the two. There's no causation to establish that correlation. And, the Great Pyramid is cocooned in a massive layer of misinformation and misinterpretation. And one of the efforts I'm trying to do is to kind of peel away a lot of that falsehood. And not necessarily people have to believe what I say.
No.
But they need to understand that the biblical correlation theory is poorly conceived with invalid research methods.
Yes.
And the Orion correlation theory uses the same invalid research methods. And Egyptology is just as guilty as being very poorly conceived science, if you want to use the word loosely. Egyptology has never moved a 70-ton payload 1 inch.
Yeah.
But working people can do it all day long. Isn't that weird?
Right.
The Erie Canal in the 1830s could move 70-ton payloads on the barge, 70 tons of grain or gravel, coal. So they could do it in the 1830s. They could move 70-ton payloads, but modern Egyptologists can't do it. The largest stone they've ever moved is the one in their kidney.
And you know, we do know that the ancient Egyptians built dams. We know that they dammed parts of the river. We know that they managed flows of the Nile outside of its flooding times. We know that they were masters of the Nile River. They
were masters. They measured its flow and, you know, in a number of places. And that's how they determined taxes, if you will. If you had this much river flow that year, then you were expected to produce this much, you know, grain or whatever. And then you would pay that at the temples. And but we think the Great Pyramid helped people in a tangible way. You know, it functioned and provided prosperity. And in a clean, environmentally friendly way, no pollution whatsoever, an efficient manner. That pumped water can be used for many different purposes. You know, power heavy machinery, create compressed gas, highly compressed air. You know, that can be used to create high voltage static electricity. And a whole host of things you can do with compressed air. You can create refrigeration with compressed air, and very hot places for scientific experimentation. So I see the Giza Plateau as a science center or industrial park that these geniuses used their technologies for, much more than some sort of a graveyard or anything like that.
Yeah, precisely. And I think the use of the Great Pyramid as a tomb is very simplistic for something of that scale, and once again does not really fit with what we know of traditional Egyptian religious culture. At least from what Egyptology itself tells us about traditional Egyptian religious culture. And the need for the script on the walls, being buried with it. It's present nowhere there. Very few inscriptions.
Let me put it this way. If the Great Pyramid was a tomb, it was an utter failure, and the original builders wasted their time, and it was a fool's errand, and they were had a stupid design, and they were dumb.
Yeah.
If it was a tomb. Long open passages don't protect the pharaoh's mummy.
Yeah.
But the ancient builders were geniuses. And so they were too smart to make a poorly conceived tomb like that. So the complexity of the interior of the Great Pyramid speaks certainly more to some sort of a machine than it does to a tomb. Egyptologists say, well, the reason why there's so many passages and chambers is there was a change of plans because we think the Great Pyramid's a tomb, and it don't look like a tomb, but it is a tomb. So the builders didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, it was. I've heard the hypothesis of it started. You know, they built the underground chamber first because if the king was going to die, then you know at least they had somewhere to put him. And then that became the queen's chamber after they got up above ground. You know, because, well, the king's got to be higher than the queen. And then as they got higher, that became the Grand Gallery, which, I don't know that that's not necessarily a master way to build a large structure in such a way to just keep changing the interior of it as you go along.
Yeah. Theory was just pulled out of the hat. Because it didn't meet their preconceived notions of what the Great Pyramid was. And they say, well, Egyptologists say, well, we know it was for a funeral because the ancient thieves stole everything, all the treasure, before us modern Egyptologists could steal it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and then because there's no evidence that proves it.
Yeah,
that's Egyptology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that science is in crisis. Sciences come and go, and Egyptology is the phrenology of the 21st century.
That is an interesting assessment, the phrenology.
Yes.
It does get into a lot of convoluted areas that really do not support each other. When it comes to Egyptology.
Well, it's convoluted because Egyptology doesn't use the scientific method. Mm. There's the mole test for the different hardnesses of rock.
Yep.
Okay. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
You understand that? They take two pieces of rock and they rub it together and they can determine which one's harder than the other.
Yeah.
Nothing's convoluted, no controversy, but Egyptology doesn't use the scientific method. So they just tell these stories and go from there. It's not convoluted how a teepee was built, because you can go watch a teepee being built. There's nothing convoluted about it because they use the scientific method. That's what it's for, is to separate falsehoods from truth. But Egyptology refuses to use the scientific method. They say people with hammers and chisels made casing stones, okay? But nobody on earth, including the science of Egyptology, has ever made a casing stone, ever. Well, there's probably several reasons. One good reason is because their explanation is wrong. They weigh up to 16 tons, casing stones, carved to perfection on all six sides. Egyptology has never even tipped a stone weighing about 15 tons on its side to finish the bottom.
Yeah.
So it's just bizarre. As many cows have jumped over the moon as Egyptologists have made casing stones. It's just a bizarre 19th century pseudoscience, Egyptology is, and it is in crisis. I don't know anyone past the eighth grade that's looked into this subject who believes that casing stones can be made using hand tools.
Mm. Mm.
You know, and it's withering on the vine. It's the richest science in the world, Egyptology, with its museum space, priceless artifacts, and also ticket-buying public to come look at the artifacts that have been stolen, but they can't engage in the scientific method.
Yeah.
It is a 18th century paradigm that was going to go the way of the biblical correlation theory and phrenology, because none of those things can withstand the rigors of the scientific method. And that's why Egyptology is so convoluted with all of their bizarre contradictory stories and explanations. You know, they pick up a rock that has a scratch on it and they say, oh, that's a hieroglyph that tells us who built the pyramid.
Yeah.
You know, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, the idea that, that so much of it contradicts itself. I'm not going to say necessarily the histories, King's List, things like that, because those are written down. But man, when you start talking about the hypotheses of how society worked, the hypotheses of, how their technology worked, how, yes, how these things were built, it's almost anathema to talk about amongst them. And it oh, yeah, once again, is interesting to see that because, more than I think any other science out there, the questioning is not allowed.
Oh, yeah. Ask Graham Hancock. You know, they eviscerated him when he talks, yeah, about different aspects of different things, as well as Christopher Dunn, who's based on geology science,
yeah,
thinks the Sphinx is older than Egyptologists come up with. So he's, you know, eviscerated, and eviscerating somebody else is not part of science.
Yeah.
And if you can't question something, and Dr. Zuhi Hawass has a conniption fit when you're trying to discuss aspects of ancient Egypt, then that's not science. So Egyptology is actually a pseudoscience. I made a video, mm-hmm, on my YouTube channel about, is Egyptology a pseudoscience? And we went through a whole number of bullet points. And it seems to be a pseudoscience to me. And, you know, we're just waiting for those people to die off.
Yeah.
That's what we had to do with the Piltdown skull. It was acknowledged to be valid by the best scientists in the world for 40 years.
Yep.
And the reason why it was that long is because we had to wait for all the people that wrote their doctoral thesis on the Piltdown skull to die off. And then the next generation of anthropologists came up and already knew the Piltdown skull was invalid. So nobody changed their minds.
Yeah.
We just had to wait a whole generation for the truth to come out. Science oftentimes advances funeral by funeral. And we're waiting for more funerals of Egyptologists to get out of the way, so we, yeah, can pursue truth.
Sadly, you are not wrong in that way. The march of science can be slow. It can be slow. It can be molasses slow. And you know, some of that is for good reason, because of the poking and prodding, the want of repetitive science, you know, the want of the proper scientific method. Okay, we've run it through the wash once. Will it go through again? Will it go through independently over here through the same, right, process? But at the same token, you have so many things, Stephen, like this, once again, where it's like, why can't we court another idea? Because the one you're floating doesn't even float in the water you're presenting it in. You know,
yeah.
You know, when, like, I'm getting ready to, in a month, go to the Shakespeare Authorship Controversy Conference in Denver.
Wow.
And I can't wait for it. My friends who are theater majors typically text me whenever I do an episode about, oh, you're joking. It's like, feel free to look at it. Feel free to look. You tell me, oh, yeah, how a cabbage farmer knew the inner workings of the royal families. All right. You do- and how he was allowed to write about him without being beheaded. You know,
right,
that in and of itself doesn't make sense to me. Much less the rest of the evidence that, you know, much like we say with curious research. I've started curious research, recently, Stephen, because, we need a better realm of what we call evidence. Evidence, everybody, that is what exonerates you in court. Don't let it be less than that. Anything else? Red circle around it, hypothesis, what have you. What you have there is data that you're adding to a data set. And sometimes what you call from the data set is more important than what you keep in the data set.
Oh, yeah.
You know, So the term in science of killing your darlings, you know, being willing to, hey, even though I came up with the hypothesis, what you just came up with totally disproves the hypothesis. All right, on to the next. That's science. And you've got to be willing to dispassionately let that go. And like you're saying, the science of Egyptology does not dispassionately let it go.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, it's become a Egyptology, I think, has become a mystery religion and a cult. You talked about evidence, and people often confuse direct physical evidence with interpretation of evidence.
Yeah.
That big pile of rocks on the Giza Plateau, the Great Pyramid, is evidence.
Well,
but correlations are not evidence.
Well,
correlations are interpretations of evidence.
That's right. Circumstantial evidence is evidence too, but it's not the kind of evidence that you're allowed to keep in a court of law, you know?
Right.
Because it's circumstantial. It's not founded on anything other than the circumstance.
Right. So people that study the Great Pyramid often aren't well versed in making these distinctions between evidence and interpretation of evidence, that type of thing. And they say, well, yeah, Great Pyramid correlation is evidence and it's precise. I say, well, what about those biblical correlations that are precise? Oh, well, they're not evidence.
Yeah.
You know, but, and it becomes bizarre. And science has the purpose of making a distinction between what is true and what is not true. But unfortunately, science, let me describe science to you.
Please.
Science is a process that embraces falsehoods. Full stop.
Yeah.
So that's not good. And when that happens, that's not science. For example, the Piltdown skull. They didn't say, well, we're going to study that for 40 years. They looked at it and they said, it is valid. Full stop. But they embraced falsehoods. And that's what's going on with Egyptology, is that so-called science, without using the scientific method, is embracing falsehoods.
Precisely. And that's how you end up with doctrines. That's how you end up with science becoming a religion instead of it being science, you know, because the day it stops evolving, it's not science anymore. It's a doctrine.
Well, Egyptology is stagnated. You know, it's the same as it was 100 years ago. It's the only science that is essentially stagnant. You know, it's the same. And that is a poor indicator of a science. Math, physics, metallurgy, and all these others are advancing leaps and bounds. You know, you have to replace the textbooks every 5 years or sooner. But in Egyptology, you can use a 19th century textbook and it's all the same. Horse hockey.
it's still fantastic reference material. Stephen.
That's what we're trying to do, is separate all of that and look at the Great Pyramid with new eyes and understand it on a technical level.
Absolutely.
Not religion or anything like that. So you can understand on a technical level how Notre Dame was built.
That's right.
But you don't have to open the Bible to understand how Notre Dame was assembled or read, you know, anything like that. So that's what we're trying to do. Purely technical, and peel away all of the periphery other stuff and go from there. If you want to know how the High Aswan Dam was built, you don't need to learn Russian. You don't have to read Russian or learn it.
Yeah.
It was built by the Russian, was Soviet Union, but you don't on a technical level, you don't have to understand that. So it's a good way to peel away all of that other stuff, is just to understand how it was built. But most people either say it was a big ramp, but it's never really been demonstrated.
Yep.
Or it was the aliens' magic wand.
Yeah.
And then how it was built is done to most people.
Yeah. Well, and I love our conversations into this, because it's once again the every time I see an article about, you know, new courses of the Nile, things like that, I share it with you. Because it's fascinating to look at the actual practicality of the hypothesis that you have put forth, not only of the construction of the pyramid using dams and locks, but the actual function of the pyramid as a means by which to pump water to the local valley to keep it fertile and lush and keep everything going. So thank you so much for all the work that you do at the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to get the new book, Stephen, the Pharaoh's Pump Analyzed.
Yeah, my third book just came out, and it's in ebook format only. It's pretty long, a lot of illustrations, and everything about what I'm doing can be learned about by going to our foundation's website, thepump.org, and you can find out what our activities are, what our goals are, that type of thing. You can contact me through email, that type of thing. Links to our YouTube channel, Facebook page, where we have a lot of fun with different things, and upcoming events, that type of thing. So our video series, is all of that information can be received through going to thepump.org. And if they want to contact me, they certainly can ask questions if they want, or become part of what we're doing. They can spread the word, mention it on social media, or put a link on their website about what we're doing, or watch the video series that we have, both of them. They can pray for us, or even give a donation. Absolutely. That would be tax deductible. So whatever they want to do, but primarily go to the website and read the books, and then you'll be part of the revolution.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, Stephen, as always, for coming on. Once again, I love our conversations into this topic. It is great to be able to peel back some of the, just malarkey that's out there. I'll just say that. And get to actual science and hypothesis and what the actual means of human ingenuity are, because we have the means by which to save our planet right here in our own noggin. We've just lost our way to it. So, thank you so much for your time as always. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience.
Thank you, Chris.
Absolutely. While you are online checking out everything from Stephen Myers and the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation at thepump.org, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share, comment. That is where you can find the store, CuriousRealm.com/store, where you can find not only the work of Stephen Myers, but also all of our guests. You can find tons of binaural beat therapy music, as well as the all new Field Observation and Encounter Log, everybody. If you are a paranormal investigator, if you're out in the field hunting for Sasquatch, doing UFO, UAP, investigations, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is for you. It is made specifically for you to gather your data while you're in the field, while it's fresh, before the data starts getting corrupted by your own memory, by your own filter of experience, things like that. So stop on by, get your copy today. CuriousResearch.org is the website for that, everybody. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your open minds, your open hearts, everybody. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services. CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.